Well, happy feast, everybody. Ah, that didn't sound very good. That sounded like you're rejoicing. Happy feast, everybody. All right. Everybody enjoying things so far? Yeah, all right. Yeah, we had a good opening last night. Got a chance to meet some new people I haven't met before. And I know there's more new people that I really don't know here, so I'm looking forward to meeting them. And I hope you are looking forward to meeting everybody as well. And that's one of the reasons we do a lot of the things together, like the group meals and stuff. So please, if you are new to this group, join us for the meals and activities. There is no charge. We want everybody welcome to be here and everybody to fellowship together and everybody to get to know the other members of their family. God's family is a wonderful thing, and he tells us to get together and celebrate together, so that's what we do try to do. One of the other things he does tell us, too, is also that we're supposed to learn and come before him and worship him. And we had an opportunity to worship with music this morning. And we'll have plenty of more opportunities and many different styles of music. And that is a real blessing to us that we can have things that we aren't used to. And I really enjoyed that set this morning because that's not what we usually have every week. And it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing. And we can rejoice together and share our differences and share our skills. And that's one of the things we're here to do, is offer ourselves up to each other. Our skills, whether it's conversation or otherwise. So today, what I want to do as we kick off this Feast of Tabernacles is to look at some scriptures that we normally look at. And a lot of scriptures that say the same thing over and over again. And when I find that there's things that are there that's said over and over again, it's something we should pay attention to. And sometimes we don't look at the little details. And so that's one of the things we're going to do today. So these scriptures that we're going to go through are going to probably be familiar to everybody, young and old, that are here. And that's good. But I'm going to try to pick out lessons that maybe we're not picking up on. And some of us may have picked up on some of them and maybe ignored the others. But there's little subtle messages throughout these scriptures. And there's lessons to be learned. So let's go through some of these, see what they have to say to us, and see how we can apply them throughout the rest of the feast. And that's the pretty cool thing, is that when we're here together, we have a safe environment to learn and practice in with each other, because we're all together. We know we all have faults, but we all know we're striving for the same thing, the kingdom of God. And we're trying to become his. So let's start in Leviticus 23, verse 33. Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, on the 15th of this seventh month is the Feast of Booths, for 7 days to the Lord. On the first day is a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work of any kind. For 7 days you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the eighth day you'll have a holy convocation and present an offering by fire to the Lord. It is an assembly. You shall do no laborious work." So here we are, first day. And we have an assembly, a gathering before God. Do we ever spend time and think that, hey, God requested an assembly with us? Assembly with you. Each one of you. He called you to come before God and to be assembled in a holy convocation because he cares about you. And he wants to spend that time with you. Each one of us individually matters to God. He says, get together and come before me. And you're going to have a celebration. And you're not going to spend time working. You're going to spend time before me rejoicing. Spend time with your family of God. And he says to come and be ready to present an offering by fire. And whenever I see that offering by fire, it reminds me when we go to Romans 12 and verse 1, it starts talking about how we're supposed to live our lives as offerings, as daily sacrifices. And so then the question comes, how do I do that? How do I be a daily sacrifice? Like I said, it's a safe environment to practice here at the feast. It's a safe environment. We're family. So we should be practicing bringing an offering by fire. And usually by fire means there's an intensity there. There's a desire there. Goes on in 37 and said, "These are the appointed times of the Lord, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations." These are God's holy times, not ours. Not mine, not yours, God's holy times. And you're to proclaim them. You're to make proclamation. You're to declare that these are God's times that we're together for. We're here before Him because He called us and He set these times apart. We're to come to present offerings by fire to the Lord. And I find this is fascinating. He doesn't just say present offerings. He gives a list. He says burnt offerings and grain offerings, sacrifices and drink offerings. Each day's matter on its own day. Besides those of your Sabbaths of the Lord, and besides your gifts, and besides all your votive and freewill offerings, which you give to the Lord. Do you get up every morning of the feast and say, well, I'm supposed to offer, make an offering today? Now, we're not talking financial offerings. We're talking offerings of your life. We are to get up, and we're coming here to the feast to give of ourselves, of our entire substance, when we start looking at this list. And he says, each day that should be a thought in our mind. How are we going to offer ourselves to the family of God and to God this day? Because the command is, each day, there is to be an offering for that day. So how do we do that? You know, and I know we come here at the feast, and I got a picture up here that kind of shows the bounty that Israel would be seeing throughout the seasons leading up to the feast and the things that they would be harvesting. And those things were bounty from God. And we come to the feast every year. Do we take inventory of how God has blessed us through the past year? We've had trials. We've had struggles. We've had difficulties. We've had people here that have had difficulties and cars breaking down on their way here. Is that our focus? Or is how God got us through that? How God blessed us through the trials that we've had? Because we still, everybody here, I don't see anybody that looks like they're starving to death. I don't see anybody that doesn't have clothes to wear. This room is comfortable, maybe a little bit too hot for some of us, but it's too cool for some others. And we complain about those things. Well, if we're complaining about those things, we're truly a blessed people. So we have a lot to be inventoried, a lot to be thankful for. We have a lot to be concerned that, hey, we do have a God who cares about us and called us here together to be blessed before Him. Verse 39 says, on exactly the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered in the crops of your land, so you've done that inventory, you gathered all your crops of the land, you shall celebrate the feast of the Lord for 7 days, with a rest on the first day and a rest on the eighth day. Now on the first day you shall take for yourselves the foliage of beautiful trees, palm branches, boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. Oh, we got a terrible God that tells us we got to go rejoice before Him. These are great things. And He tells us to take these beautiful things, and we'll have an opportunity afterwards to take some branches, some leaves, and some willows, and some palms, and put them on the sukkah to help us rejoice. Let's continue on. Verse 41, and you shall thus celebrate it as a feast to the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations. You shall celebrate it in the seventh month, and you shall live in booths for 7 days. All the native born in Israel shall live in booths, so that your generations may know that I had the sons of Israel live in booths when I brought them out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So Moses declared to the sons of Israel the appointed times of the Lord. So we come here together, and you know, in Israel, there's some pictures up here of some different booths that people will actually stay in. The top picture's in Jerusalem. And they will spend their time of the Feast of Booths in these things. And we come to our temporary dwellings. This hotel that we're in is a temporary dwelling. We'll build a sukkah over here. We'll put the branches and stuff on it. And we've actually put the offering box under there because that's a meeting with God. It's between you and God. And it's so neat that we can come before God and we can live in a temporary dwelling and we know where our focus is. We have the blessings from God and we're able to celebrate before Him. I think it was pretty cool in ancient Israel when they actually did dwell in booths. And He says, remember this, brought them out of Israel. And He dwelt with them. The tabernacle was in the midst of their camp. they lived in tents and they surrounded the tabernacle, and it was in order. God told them where to place their tents around based on the family and tribe they were from. God does things in order. But in the center was the tabernacle, and they had a visual sign, that pillar of cloud during the day and fire by night. God was in their presence. The glory of God, and they knew it, and they get up and they look out their tent. Are we seeing that glory of God? Do we recognize him and the things that we see throughout this feast and as well as throughout our lives? But we're all together gathered here. It should be concentrated. We should be seeing the glory of God in each and every one of us. And we each bring a piece of that and we share it with one another. So this must have been something cool as a reminder to them of who they were and how God was special to them. And in the middle was that tabernacle where God resided with them. The glory in over the Holy of Holies. And they were all camped around it. Well, we are camped around God. We are temporarily living here together with one another. And all these things that happened in the past, 1 Corinthians tells us, is for us, for our example. So in 1 Corinthians 10, it says, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, and were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and the sea. They ate the same spiritual food, and they all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave the evil things that they also craved. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play." I'll tell you, this week I think we're going to do sitting down to eat and drink, and we are going to stand up to play. But we need to remember not to crave those idolatrous things, not to be like them. What they did and that caused them to fall in the wilderness was they lost sight of God's presence among them. They lost sight that they were special, that God lived in among them, and they all shared that same thing. So as it continues on, verse 8 says, "Nor let any of us act immorally as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord as some of them did, and they were destroyed by the serpents, nor grumble." We like that one, I think. I think we got that. We grumble. "As some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. No temptation has overtaken you, but such is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow us to be tempted beyond what you are able, but that your temptation will provide a way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." Anything that comes between us and God is idolatry. And that's what it boils down to. They fell to the idols of their desires. We're not to do that, especially this week. And again, this week is a great time to practice, to overcome things, to share our gifts, our talents, our skills. Even though we may not like them, you know what? They're a blessing to others. And we need to do that. Fellowshipping with one another. We come from all parts of this country together in this spot. God placed you here. We have all these different backgrounds. God placed us here. Each and every one of you was placed here by God, by a set of circumstances maybe that were way beyond your control. That's God working in your life. That's God directing your steps. Now what are you going to do with it that you're here? Let's look at some more scriptures that are familiar again, but about these days. Deuteronomy 16. In verse 13, it says, "You shall celebrate the Feast of Booths 7 days after you've gathered from your threshing floor and your wine vat, and you shall rejoice in your feast." Again and again and again, these scriptures keep telling us, okay, we've gathered everything in. Now rejoice. Can you take that to heart? All the things that passed in the past year, you've survived. He got you through. He tells us to rejoice in your feast. And not only you, but it says you and your son and your daughter and your male and female servants and the Levite and the stranger and the orphan and the widow who are in your towns. 7 days you shall celebrate a feast to the Lord your God in the place which you shall, which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all the produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you will be altogether joyful. Did you catch some of the subtleties in there? There's some new things that he's introduced here that we haven't read in the other ones. Not only is he telling us to rejoice, but we're to make sure that others rejoice. We need to make sure that those that aren't as blessed as us, that may be our servants, that may be our strangers among us, that may be orphans among us, that may be widows among us, but we're to make sure that they are included too and that they will rejoice. And notice that when we do these things, God says that because we do these things, the Lord God will bless you. If we're concerned about taking care of others, if we're concerned about blessing God because he's blessed us, if we're concerned about sharing our lives as living sacrifices, as an offering to God, guess what? He promises to bless us, and not only bless us, but bless everything that we do. That's pretty cool stuff. And we can obtain that by coming here at the feast and doing what he says. Verse 16, 3 times in a year all your males shall appear before God, the Lord your God, in the place which he chooses, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Booths. And they shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which he has given you. God has blessed each one of you with life, with clothing, with food, with skills. Everyone in here has a skill. I don't know what they all are. Sometimes we fight those, but we all have them. He's blessed us, so we're to bless as he's given us blessings. And we're to think about it. How can I do it? I mean, it's not just show up and just let things happen. He says, contemplate it. Think about how you've been blessed, and how am I going to share that on? Verse 18, and I find this very interesting, that we're here in the middle of this feast stuff, and he's telling us how we're to come before him. And then he goes into a discourse and says, you shall appoint yourself judges and officers in all your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice. You shall not be partial. You shall not take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice and only justice you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land in which the Lord your God is giving you. We all seek a land. We all seek a land, that kingdom with God. And we want to be blessed in that. And this feast pictures that land, that kingdom. He says we better learn justice and mercy and how to do justice correctly, righteously, like he does. That's something that we need to learn and do. And he ties it right here in what he's given instructions about his feast days. These are things that we need to take a part of and say, what is he trying to tell me? And how can I do that? How do I execute justice here in those that I come in contact with? How do I do mercy? How do I do it righteously as God would do it? Again, this is a great place to practice safely. Safely among friends. And then verse 21 says, you shall not plant for yourself an asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make for yourself, and you shall not set up for yourself a sacred pillar which the Lord your God hates. Remember how we read that seeking our own will and ways leads to idolatry? Well, an asherah pole was actually set up in Israel, and it was to the god Asherah, the female god of heaven. And interesting enough, NBC News, of all places, ran a story just recently about how the god of Israel has a wife because they found an Asherah pole next to a sacred place to Yahweh. And so the conclusion was, Mother God with Yahweh, God must have been married. And it's because they couldn't flee idolatry. The world, in general, has a false impression of God. How careful are we not to mix things? How careful are we that when we come together to celebrate the feast and be thankful for all the things that we have, that we do it God's way? So that the world gets the right impression of what we're doing. This is a strange thing for these people that see us come together at this time of year when school's going on and people have just finished their farming. Some places are still rushing to get their crops in from the field. And these people all assemble in strange places like Rapid City, South Dakota, take 8 days off to spend together and before the God that they worship. What do we bring? What kind of things do we confuse things with? Let's go to Exodus 23, verse 14. Again, a lot of these words are very familiar. We've read them, but there's sometimes there's a little different things. And what is that difference, and what does it mean? And how should we look at it? 14, three times a year you shall obey a feast to me. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread for 7 days. You are to eat unleavened bread as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. You shall also observe the feast of harvest of the first fruits from your labors, from what you sow in the field. Also, the feast of end gathering at the end of the year when you have gathered the fruit of your labors from the field. Three times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord your God, and you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor is the fat of my feast to remain overnight until morning. You shall bring the choice first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. You are not to boil a young goat in the milk of its mother. That ending's a little bit different than we've had. You know, first we have, you know, we've talked about we're supposed to bring our offerings, our offering our lives and stuff. And it says here it's your choice. It's the good things. It's the first of the first, the best. So when we come here, do we come to share the best that we have to offer, the best of ourselves? And it may be, you know, running the sound back there. How many of us can do that? Not many. We're thankful we got somebody that can share that skill set with us. How about the music we had this morning, the music we had last night? I'm so glad we have people to do that, because you wouldn't want me doing that. But they're sharing the best that they have to offer. Are we bringing the best that we have? Are we sharing the best that we have? We all have something a little different that can be given. But are we giving it? And are we remembering everybody when we do that? Because that's what the Word of God says. Make sure everybody else rejoices here at the feast. How are we doing that? And then the last line seems again back to that justice thing. You're not to boil a young goat in the milk of its mother. That seems like mercy. That seems like justice. That seems like something God would be trying to teach us, especially when we're gathered together. How do we execute righteous judgment with mercy? Exodus 34, verse 21. You shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks, that is, the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and the Feast of End Gathering at the turn of the year. Three times a year all your males are to appear before the Lord your God of Israel. For I will drive out nations before you and enlarge your borders, and no man shall covet your land when you go up three times a year to appear before the Lord your God. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor is it the sacrifice of the Feast of Passover to be left until morning. You shall bring the very first of the first fruits of your soil into the house of your God, and you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words. In accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did not eat bread or drink water. He wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. First thing I notice addition here that we haven't seen in any of these others is that God says, if you do these things, if you will come, I will protect your belongings that are back home. that you have left behind. I will enlarge your borders, he says, not even just protect things. I will enlarge your borders. I will take care of those things that you've left behind. Easton's Bible Dictionary actually found this very interesting, and they went back through history, and they tried to do a study, and they record that on any of the feast days, the three pilgrim festivals, from the time that Moses received the covenant from God, we're talking about here, up until 30-some years after the death of Christ, they could not find an invasion on the land of Israel that happened during the feast days. But then that changed. But it was after the death of Christ that it finally changed, and Israel was attacked on the feast days. So this is according to the Easton's Bible Dictionary. And I find that interesting because this is what God promised. He promised, you go to the feast days, you put me first, you do those things that I asked you to do, and you come and celebrate before me. Don't even worry about your land. Don't worry about home. I'll take care of it. That's pretty powerful. And then the other thing that this ends up with, Moses was up on the mount for 40 days and 40 nights fasting with God. 40 days and 40 nights. That's a repeating thing that comes through the Bible. 40 is a very interesting number. I could spend a whole couple of hours on that number. But what I want to do is just quickly give you a list of things that the 40 can kind of symbolize. Because 40 is a period of judgment. It's a period of testing. It's a period of teaching. Israel was 40 years in the wilderness where they were tested before God. And unfortunately, they tested God too. But 40 is a period that we read about in Leviticus 23 that we're supposed to remember that they lived in booths for those 40 years. Also in Deuteronomy 16. In Exodus 16, we have about the manna that God fed them through that whole time and provided for their substance, and yet they didn't learn the lesson and they failed that test. Genesis 7 and 8 talks about when God rained on the earth and flooded the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, when he executed judgment upon the earth and the people of the earth. Exodus 24, we just read, Moses goes up for 40 days and 40 nights. He receives the tablets of stone. Exodus 34, didn't do a whole lot of good the first time, so he had to go up a second time, because by the time Moses got back down, they had done the golden calf, and he broke the tablets. Matthew 4, verse 2, talks about how Christ fasted for 40 days before he started his ministry. So 40 days and 40 nights, and then he was tempted and tested by Satan. Acts 1, Christ appeared to the disciples after his resurrection for 40 days and worked with them from the time he was resurrected until the time he ascended for another 40 days. 40 days is a period of teaching and testing and trials, but of purification as well. So Hebrews chapter 3, verse 7 says, therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they were provoked me, as in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tried me by testing me and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore I was angry with this generation and said, they always go astray in their hearts and they did not know my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Take care, brethren, that there may not be any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. Take care, brethren, that there may not be any of one of you with an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. You want to fall away? It's a matter of heart. It's a matter of not believing. So we need to be careful and guard our hearts. Verse 13, but encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ, and if we hold fast from the beginning of our assurance firm until the end, while it is said, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts, as when they provoked me. For who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, did not all those who came out of Egypt, led by Moses, and with whom he was angry for 40 years, was it not with those who had sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness, and to whom he did swear so that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they are not able to enter because of unbelief. We're here together. And it says, encourage one another day by day. We're here together as a large group. We have that opportunity to encourage one another day by day. Are we going to be doing these things? If we do those things, remember, we're blessed. He will protect us. Deuteronomy 31. It says, so Moses wrote the law and gave it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who carried the Ark of the Covenant, and all the elders of Israel. And then Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the time of the year of the remission of debts, at the Feast of Booths, when all of Israel comes to appear before God, the Lord your God, at the place which he will choose, you shall read this law in front of all of Israel in their hearing. Assemble the people, the men and women and children and alien who is in your town, so that they may hear and learn and fear the Lord your God, and be careful to observe all the words of the law, of this law. For their children who have not known will hear and learn to fear the Lord your God, as long as you live on the land which you are about to cross the Jordan to possess. This is pretty powerful. This is why we're here, and this is why we're reading the law. Because we're supposed to read the law at the feast. Very specifically, every 7 years, the year of remission, the year of release. And what is the law, really? What is really the law? It's a picture of God's holiness. It's not a bunch of do's and don'ts. It's who God is. It's his character. It's a description of him. And he wants us to get to know him. So we study the Bible at his feast. We study his word. We study his law. We look into those things, and then we have an opportunity to practice those things. And notice, it's supposed to be the entire family. This isn't a men's only club. We've read in several of the other scriptures, all the men are commanded to appear before them. Here it says, the men, the women, and the children, and the alien are to come and hear it. Hear it. And the children will be convicted. It's amazing what the little children that are on the floor and around this room are picking up right now, because they're hearing it. They may not be paying attention, but it always surprises me later when they come back and say, when this was said, or that was said, or this was done, oh, I thought you were over in the corner playing. Now God says, have them come here, the children, because they too will hear the law and they will learn. The law is something that we examine and examines ourselves. It's the mirror that we should be comparing ourselves with, not with each other. Not with each other, because why would I compare myself to somebody else? We should be caring for God, because that's who we're trying to reflect after. That's who we're trying to become after. So it's his word that reveals his holiness and his character. And that's what we study, and that's what we look at, and that's what we compare ourselves to. In Deuteronomy 31, God knew when he gave all these things that Israel would fall away. Hence, we've got 1 Corinthians 10 that we had already read, that it was an example for us. But God knew it, and he predicted it. In verse 14, he says, and the Lord said to Moses, behold, the time for you to die is near. Call Joshua and present yourselves at the tent of meeting, that I may commission him. So Moses and Joshua went and presented themselves at the tent of meeting. And the Lord appeared in the tent in a pillar of cloud. And the pillar of cloud stood at the doorway of the tent. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, you are about to lie down with your fathers. And this people will arise and play the harlot with the strange gods of the land, in the midst of which they are going. And they will forsake me and break my covenant, which I have made with them. Then my anger will be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them and hide my face from them. And they will be consumed, and many evils and troubles will come upon them, so that they will say in that day, is it not because our God is not among us that these things, these evils, have come upon us? But surely I will hide my face in that day because of all the evil which they do, for they will turn to other gods. They didn't learn that lesson of understanding and learning about God and his character and taking it to heart and becoming like it and reflecting that in their lives and looking at that picture. So they fell away. They went to idolatrous things. But God knew that. But he had them do it for an example for us. So we would say, going their own way, seeking after other gods, seeking after the idols of the land, the gods of the land, can lead us away and lead us astray. It's very important to take everything into account to God's law. Deuteronomy 15 talks about that year of remission, that year of release. Every 7 years when the law was to be read, there was a lot more things that actually happened at the feast because it was a year of release. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit, and we're going to read through it rather quickly. There was a lot that happened at the feast, and that was a lot of things, and therefore a lot of people had that they could rejoice at. So it says in verse 1, at the end of every 7 years you shall grant a remission of debts. This is the manner of remission. Every creditor shall release what he has loaned to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor or and his brother, because the Lord's remission has proclaimed it. From a foreigner you may exact it, but your hand shall release whatever of yours is with your brother. However, there will be no poor among you, since the Lord your God will surely bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess. If you would only listen obediently to the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all the commandments which I am commanding you today, for the Lord your God will bless you as he has promised, and you will lend to nations, but you will not borrow. And you will rule over many nations, but they will not rule over you. Remember, God said, go to the feast, be joyful, bless others, come to give, come to share, come to bring your offering of yourself, to bring that whatever you can bring, to assess where you're at, and come and share, and you'll be blessed, and he'll truly bless you in all the things that you do. Here he repeats that and says, every 7 years, do that. And if you do it, guess what? There won't be any poor. Last I checked, we're probably not doing a good job because we do have poor. But he says, there will be poor, but if you would do what I tell you, you would not have any poor. You would be truly blessed. It continues on, 7. There is a poor man with you, one of your brothers, in any of your towns in your land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not harden your heart nor close your hand from your poor brother. You shall freely open your hand to him and shall generously lend to him sufficient for his need in whatever he lacks. Beware, there is no base thought in your heart saying, the 7th year, the year of remission is near, and your eye is hostile towards your poor brother, and you give him nothing. Then he may cry to the Lord against you, and it will be a sin in you. You shall generously give to him, and your heart shall not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord is your God will bless you in all your work and all your undertakings. For the poor will never cease to be in the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your needy and poor in your land. See, this is a test of our attitude. The test of our thought process. Verse 12, if your kinsman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, then he shall serve you 6 years, but in the 7th year you shall set him free. When you set him free, you shall send him away, shall not send him away empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, from your wine vat. You shall give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. Again, God blesses us. What are we supposed to do? Bless others. And you know, when that person worked for that person for 7 years, for 6 years before he was released, he trained him. He taught him how to do and produce. And then God was blessed, or you were blessed through that person. God was blessing you. Then you blessed them when you released them. You didn't just send them out on their way. You gave them substance to start with. Verse 15, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. See, God did it to us first. God pulled us out of this world. Therefore, I command you this today. It shall come about if he says to you, I will not go out from you because he loves you and your household, since he fares well with you. Then you shall take an awl and pierce it through his ear into the door, and he shall be your servant forever, and you shall do likewise to your maidservant. Verse 18. And it shall not seem hard to you when you set him free, for he has given you 6 years with double the service of a hired man, so that the Lord your God will bless you in whatever you do. That person was indebted to you, and he was so grateful, he worked hard. And then you are to bless him. 19. You shall consecrate to the Lord your God all the firstborn males that are born of your herd, your flock. You shall not work with the firstborn of your herd, nor shear the firstborn of your flock. You and your household shall eat it every year before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses. We are the firstborn males. We are the firstborn of God. We are the firstborn children. We collect where he chooses and come before him. And he tells us to bring the firstborn of our flocks here, the best, the choice. And then he says in verse 21, but if it has any defect, such as lameness or blindness or any serious defect, you shall not sacrifice it to the Lord your God. You shall eat it within your gates. The unclean and clean alike may eat it, as the gazelle or the deer, only you shall not eat the blood. You are to pour it out on the ground like water. Historian Josephus, in the Antiquity of the Jews, recorded this. And this is, I find, interesting to read just because it gives a perspective of the first century of what this was actually should be like and what was the meaning of it. So it says, when the multitudes are assembled together into the holy city for sacrificing every seventh year at the Feast of Tabernacles, let the high priest stand upon a high desk whence he may be heard, and let him read the law to all the people, and let neither the women nor the children be hindered from hearing. No, nor the servants neither, for it is a good thing that those laws should be engraven in their souls and preserved in their memories, that so it may be possible to blot them out. For by this means they will not be guilty of sin. Understanding God's law does protect us from sin. Goes on to say, when they cannot plead ignorance of what the laws have enjoined them, these laws will also have greater authority among them as foretelling what they will suffer if they break them, and imprinting on their souls by this hearing what they command them to do, so that they may always be in their minds that intention of the laws which they have despised and broken, and thereby been the causes of their own mischief. Let the children also learn the laws as the first thing that they are taught, which is the best thing that can be taught, and will be the cause of their future felicity. God's laws just teach us how to live and how to be blessed. And like he said, if you do the things I tell you, I will bless you beyond measure. I will bless everything that you do. I will bless the work of your hands. And you'll be able to come to the feast year by year and rejoice and share that blessing with others and encourage others and bring others up so that they can be blessed too. The ancient Israelites knew this. The ancient historians knew this. And so this is one of the lessons that is of the Feast of Tabernacles. We're not only to be hear, but we're to hear God's ways, and we're to make sure others hear those ways. And it might be just by watching our actions that they hear those ways. Because nothing speaks louder than actions. And when others see our actions, they should be hearing the Word of God and seeing the Word of God in action. I'd like to talk now about a few customs that were in place in Christ's day in the temple. Now, I know these are customs of man, okay? And these customs here, there's a couple of them that at least date back to 165 B.C. So before Christ, 165 years, we have recordings of these customs being done. And they were done in the day of Christ. And I find them interesting because what they do is they point some of the things that the Feast of Tabernacles is about. And they point us to the reality of it. So in here you have a picture of the Pool of Siloam. And every morning during the Feast of Tabernacles, the high priest would gather a golden pitcher, and they would do a procession down from the temple, down through the city of David, down to the pool of Siloam, and there would be a parade. They would have trumpets, and this is a joyous thing. They're at the feast to celebrate. So they would be blowing trumpets and making noise, and they would gather a pitcher of water from that pool, and they would take that back up to the temple. Now, this golden pitcher probably had about a quart, but at the same time this was happening, there would be another procession that would come out of the tabernacle, the temple. And that temple, they would go down and they would gather the branches. They would gather trees, willows, and they would bring them back to the temple. Because remember, we're supposed to celebrate with the willows, the branches and stuff. Well, they would have another procession. And they would go down south. There was a region where they had these nice willows that would grow tall and they'd be flexible and they were light and they could carry them. And they would bring them back. Now, this is a map of actually the city of Jerusalem. And right here is the temple. And down here is on the very tip is the Pool of Siloam. And so there would be this big procession with a lot of joyousness, a lot of music, a lot of joy, because they were here. They made it to another feast. Now, in the temple, went the wrong way. The temple itself grounds, they would be coming back to the altar that stood in front of the temple. And this would be the women's court out here, and they would come in the south gate, which ended up being called the water gate because they were bringing the water in. But they would come here, and they would be preparing to do the things on the altar before God and offer the water as a libation. And this is the altar of God that they would have to climb up and make their offering in front of the temple itself. They would gather the willows and they set them up on the sides of this altar. So there would be a canopy, kind of a booth, over the top of the altar. And so that this is where the sacrifices were being burned. And it was raised up so all the people could see. And this was in the court of the priests, and so the court of the men was around the outside, and they could watch this. And the court of the women were outside of that, and then the court of the Gentiles was even farther on out beyond that. And where they had barriers around the outside is where the Gentiles could go. But the high priest would bring this water in, and they would have set out the willows up, and they would blow the trumpets. As he entered the gates, there would be three trumpets. And they would announce the fact that they're bringing the water in. And the people would be so excited and joyful, and they would shout out words from Isaiah chapter 12, verse 3. And it says, "Therefore the joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation." And they would chant this as they would bring the water up the altar of the ramp. And they would take a left turn at the top, and they would pour it out at the same time they were pouring some blood out from the sacrifices. Let's read Isaiah 12. Starting in verse 1. It says, "Then you will say on that day, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, for although you were angry with me, your anger is turned away, and you comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. For the Lord God is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. Therefore, you will joyously draw water from the springs of salvation. And in that day you will say, give thanks to the Lord and call on his name. Make known his deeds among the peoples. Make them remember that his name is exalted. Praise the Lord in song, for he has done excellent things. Let this be known throughout the earth. Cry aloud and shout for joy, O inhabitants of Zion, for great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel." So they would do this every morning of the feast for 7 days. And then on the seventh day, they go down and get the water. And when they brought it back to the temple, the seventh day, remembering what God did for them when they entered the Promised Land, land of Jericho, instead of marching around the altar once, They marched around seven times, blowing the trumpets, shouting the words that has in Isaiah, "Therefore, with joy, you will draw water from the wells of salvation." And then they would pour this out. John 7 talks about Christ in his day during the feast. Verse 1, it says, after these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for he was unwilling to walk in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. But now the feast of the Jews, the feast of booths, was near. Dropping down to verse 14, it says, but when it was now in the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began to teach. And the Jews were astonished, saying, how has this man become so learned, never been educated? So Jesus answered them, said, my teaching is not mine, but he who sent me. And if anyone willing to do his will, he was willing to know of the teaching, whether it is of God or whether I speak of myself. From who speaks of from himself seeks from his own glory, but he who is seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true, and there is no unrighteousness in him. But did not Moses give you the law? Yet none of you carries out the law. Why do you seek to kill me? The crowd answered, you have a demon who seeks to kill you. And Jesus answered them, I did one deed and you marvel. For this reason Moses has given you circumcision, not because it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. Aren't these themes already coming that we've always been reading about, righteous judgment that we're supposed to be learning at the feast? Now he's here teaching them at the feast and giving a live example of righteous judgment. And they're wrapped up in these ceremonies that are going on and seeing like the water pouring ceremony and the sacrifices that are putting on the altar, and he's teaching them what this is really about. In verse 25, and it says, some of the people of Jerusalem were saying, is this not the man whom they're seeking to kill? Look, he is speaking publicly, and they say nothing to him. You know, this would be pretty amazing, you know. They're looking for an opportunity to kill him, and he knew that, and that's why he had to go up secretly. And now he's out in the open temple, and nobody's laying a finger on him. And what he's teaching is teaching righteous judgment. How to live the law of God. So verse 26, look, he's speaking publicly and they're saying nothing to him. The rulers do not really know that this is the Christ, do they? However, we who know where this man is from, but whenever the Christ may come, who knows where he is from? Then Jesus cried out in the temple teaching, saying, you both know me and know where I am from. I have not come myself to, but he who sent me is true. Whom do you not know? I know him because I am from him, and he sent me. So they were seeking to seize him, and no man laid his hand on him because his hour had not yet come. But many of the crowd believed in him, and they were saying, when the Christ comes, he will not perform more signs than those which this man has, will he? Because they were seeing what he was doing. They were seeing what he was teaching. And they were probably the ones that actually paid attention to the law of God and the readings that were going on. Saying, it matches. How could it be somebody else? Verse 32, and the Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things about him. The chief priests and the Pharisees sent the officers to seize him. Therefore Jesus said, for a little while longer I am with you, but then I go to him who sent me. You will seek me and you will not find me. Where I am, you will not come. Now on the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood up and cried out. Now, before we read that, think about what has been going on. For the first 7 days, they marched around that altar once and poured the water out, and they were looking for that living water of salvation. The seventh day, the great day, they marched around seven times. The trumpets were blowing and blaring, and he's been stirring things up in the temple since midweek. And saying that we need to live justly, righteously, and showing how we should be doing those things. And in the middle of all these things that are going on that last day, he says, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture said, from the innermost being will flow rivers of living water. He's pointing them when the ceremonies that they just got done doing, they point to him. He provides the living water. We need to turn and believe in him. The ceremonies were all about looking to him. In verse 39, it says, but he spoke of the Spirit from those who believed in him were to receive. For the Spirit had not yet been given, but Jesus was not yet glorified. So the actions of the temple, whether they realized it or not, the verses from Isaiah were pointing to Jesus Christ, and they recognized that what they were doing in the Feast of Tabernacles was pointing to Jesus Christ, and they went through the actions, and Christ said, here I am in your midst. Come to me, believe. Don't fall like the ones in the wilderness. He is the true source of living water. And that water, his Spirit, will flow through those that believe in him. And that's what we're here practicing at the feast. Our belief in him, and then that Spirit should flow from us into all the others around us, all those that we meet throughout this week. His Spirit should flow and it should point back to him. Because it's not us, it's his Spirit. It should flow back to him. Now remember that pillar in the wilderness? There was another part of their ceremonies of those days. But remember that pillar in the wilderness? At night, the fire would go. So we had the ceremony of pouring of water, which is what we just described. But then there was the celebration of water pouring. Because then they had a celebration every night. And now there's some arguments about whether they relit fires every night or whether they did not or whether they just kept things burning throughout the whole feast. But it really doesn't matter. They did this celebration of the water pouring. And it had to do with light. And they wanted to recreate the glory of God that was in that tabernacle in the wilderness and that was also resided in Solomon's temple. And they knew it was missing from their temple. And so they put a celebration together that was trying to mimic the glory of God, symbolized by the pillar of fire in the wilderness. So they would light up the temple at night. And they put four big pillars into the woman's courtyard, and they had a big ceremony. And they were trying to duplicate what it says in Isaiah 9. In Isaiah 9 it says, but there will be no more gloom for her who is in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt, but later on he shall make it glorious. By the way of the sea, in the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in dark land, the light will shine on them. And you shall multiply the nation, and you shall increase their gladness, and they will be glad in your presence as the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice for they divide the spoil. For you shall break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle helmet and the cloak rolled in blood will be burning, fuel for the fire. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given, the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, and there will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. On the throne of David and over the kingdom to establish it and uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord will accomplish this. They knew that when Christ returned, he would establish a government. And the Feast of Tabernacles was about that government. And that government would be light to the nations. And it would go out and forth from Jerusalem and shine to all the nations. And so they were trying to force this on by this ceremony. So at the night after the water pouring ceremony, they would assemble these big pillars, candelabra, in that woman's court. And the high priest would direct these actions. They would carry oil up these long ladders. They were about, 30 meters or so, about 70 feet in height. And they'd carry this oil up. And they would take the old girls from the priests, and they use those just as wicks in these candelabras. and they'd fill them with oil and they'd light them up. And all the people would gather around this temple square, the women's court, and they would find perches that they could watch the festivities from, because this was a joyous occasion. And the priests would come down the steps from the court of the priests, and they would blow the trumpets, and the Levites would sound all these joyous sounds, and the people would dance and watch and observe. And you would probably come very early so you get a front row seat. But there were so many things going on, all the sacrifices that were going on. And these activities would go on all night long, joyous, light. Throwing of torches, that people would do their skills, and they would do juggling of lighted torches in the courtyard. And people would sing psalms and sing praises. And they would just be a night of rejoicing before God, a night of showing light, light, light coming from the temple of God, shining out from the temple to all the lands. The rabbis recorded that saying that if you had never seen the joy of this ceremony, you'd never truly experience joy. And it was all about light shining out from the temple. They say that there wasn't a courtyard within Jerusalem that wasn't lit by the lights that were lit in the temple. Those lights. And that was the joy that they were watching. But that brings us back to John chapter 7. Now, right after Christ had told them, "You want water? I'll give you living water." John 8:53 says, "Then everyone went to his home." And then we have another story about justice. And I'm not going to read that right now because we all know it. It's the woman caught in adultery. And they wanted to stone her. And they brought her before Christ and said, "Shall we stone her? Who's going to cast the first stone?" He asked them. And then he wrote something in the ground. He was again teaching a lesson from the Feast of Tabernacles. How do we execute justice and mercy? Righteous judgment. And it was in this context. And then John 8 in verse 12, after witnessing the light ceremony, what does he say next? "Then Jesus again spoke to them, saying, 'I am the light of the world.'" That ceremony was pointing to him. He was to light the world. He says, "He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but I will have the light of life." Again, it's pointing to Jesus Christ. The Feast of Tabernacles points to his reign, his time on earth. He is that light. He is the light that shines from the throne of God. He is that light, and it shines. Verse 13, "So the Pharisees said to him, 'You are testifying about yourself. Your testimony is not true.' And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Even if I testify about myself, my testimony is true. For I know where I came from and where I am going. But you do not know where I come from or where I am going. You judge according to the flesh. I am not judging anyone. But even if I do judge, my judgment is true. For I am not alone in it, but I am the Father who sent me. And you, even in your law, you have written about that testimony of two men is true. I am he who testifies about myself, and the Father who sent me testifies about me." So they were saying to him, "Where is your Father?" Jesus answered, "You know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also." And these words were spoken in the treasury as he taught in the temple. He's still in the temple, and he's still teaching these words, and he's telling, "I am that light." Jesus Christ is that light, and he's radiating from the temple at this point. He's radiating that light. "And no one seized him because his hour had not yet come. And he said to them again, 'I will go away, and you will seek me, and will die. You will die in your sin. Where I'm going, you cannot come.'" Chapter 9 says that he passed by and saw a blind man from birth, and the disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who had sinned, this man or his parents, that he'd be born blind?" And Jesus said, "It was neither the man that sinned nor his parents, but it was so the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who has sent me For as long as it's day, night is coming when no one can work. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. In case we haven't got that yet, he's still confirming he is that light. He is the light of the world. When he had said this, he spat on the ground, made clay of spittle, and applied the clay to his eyes, and said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," the same pool that they had been drawing the water from all week. He said, "Go wash in that pool." He said, which is translated sent. So he went away and washed and came back seeing. Therefore, the neighbors and those who previously saw him as a beggar were saying, "Is not the one who used to sit and beg?" And others were saying, "This is he." And others were saying, "No, but he is like him." And he kept saying, "I am the one." So they were saying to him, "How were your eyes then opened?" He had met the light of the world. He had met the man who has the living waters. He had met what the celebration was all about. And he was restored and given sight. He now saw the truth. He now saw who he was. The feast is not only about things past, things present, but it's also about things future. In Ezekiel 43, we have a vision of God, the glory of God, once again filling that temple. So in Ezekiel 43, verse 1, "Then he led me to the gate, and the gate facing towards the east. And behold, the glory of God of Israel was coming from the way of the east, and his voice was like the sound of many waters. And the earth shone with his glory, water and light." Verse 3, "And it was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I saw when he came to destroy the city, and the visions that were like the vision... I saw the river Chebar, and I fell on my face, and the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate facing towards the east. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court. And behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. Then I heard one speaking to me from the house. While a man was standing beside me, he said to me, 'Son of man, this is the place of my throne, the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell among the sons of Israel forever, and the house of Israel will not again defile my holy name. Neither they nor the kings, by their harlotry, by their corpses of their kings when they die.'" Zechariah also talks of this time in Zechariah 14, verse 1. "Behold, the day is coming for the Lord, when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, and the houses plundered, and the women ravished, and half of the city exiled. But the rest of the peoples will not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights in the day of battle. In that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives will be split in the middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half the mountain will move towards the north and the other half towards the south, and you will flee by the valley of my mountain. For the valley of the mountains will reach to Ezel. Yes, you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come and all the holy ones with him." Boy, we look forward to that time. And it continues on in verse 6. "And in that day there will be no light. The luminaries will dwindle. The sky will become darkened. For it will be a unique day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but it will come about at evening time there will be light. And in that day living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them towards the east sea and the other half towards the western sea. And it will be summer as well as in the winter. And the Lord will be king over all the earth. And in that day, the Lord will be the Holy One, will be the only one. And his name will be the only one. And the land will be changed into a plain from Geba to Rimon south of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem will rise and remain on its site from Benjamin's gate as far as the place of the first gate to the corner gate from the Tower of Hanel to the king's wine presses. The people live in it. There will be no longer a curse, for Jerusalem will dwell in security." Those promises of peace, of security, if we do what he says, they'll come about for Jerusalem one day. And we look forward to that day. And that light and living waters will be in Jerusalem, in his kingdom. This is his kingdom that's being talked about. In verse 12, and now there will be a plague which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem, and their flesh will rot and while they stand on their feet, and their eyes will rot in the sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths, and it will come about in that day a great panic from the Lord will fall upon them. And they will seize one another's hand, and the hand of one will be lifted against the hand of another. Judah will also fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations will be gathered, gold and silver, garments in abundance. So that like this plague will be the plague on the horse, the mule, the camel, the donkey, and all the cattle that will be in those camps. This is what it's going to take for man to learn his ways are not the ways of salvation. But 16 says that it will come about after all these things, after all the things that we just read, that it will come about that those who are left of all the nations that went up against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths. And it will be that whichever of the families of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. And if a family of Egypt does not go up or enter, then no rain will fall on them. It will be the plague which the Lord smites the nations who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Booths. This will be the punishment for Egypt and the punishment for all nations who do not go up. In that day, there will be described on the bells of horses, holy to the Lord, and the cooking pots in the Lord's houses will be like the bowls before the altar, and every cooking pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be holy to the Lord of hosts. And all who sacrifice will come and take them and boil in them, and there will be no longer a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts in that day. What a future. And we have a glimpse of that today, because we're here assembled during his Feast of Booths, something that the rest of the world has not learned about yet. And we're able to celebrate and share in those blessings. And we can do those things he tells us and share with one another and be truly blessed and then pass the blessings on. And the more we pass them on, the more he will bless us. And that's what he says, our pots will be full. They'll be sacred pots inscribed with his name. There are so many lessons in these scriptures of the Feast of Tabernacles. So many things that we talked about today, and there's, I don't think, probably any new scripture that I've read that you did not know. God wants us to come and meet with him. He wants time with us, with you, each individually. He wants you to come and participate by giving of yourself, giving of you. And he wants you to rejoice. He wants you to remember where we came from. He wants you to remember the people that passed before and taught us the lessons that we needed to learn. He wants us to avoid Israel's mistakes. We don't want to fall the same way. He wants us to bless and be blessed. And the two go hand in hand, and he wants us to learn that lesson. We're not going to be blessed if we're not blessing. So the more that we bless others, the more we will be blessed. He wants us to learn how to do things justly and righteously. Use his judgment, his justice, his righteousness. He wants us to be careful in our worship because we represent him. And others will see God through what that we do when we're assembled together and also when we go back home. He wants us to give him our best, the first and all. He wants us to be obedient to him. And he promises us protection through that. He promises us to take care of us. He wants us to be together with family, with the children, with the women, with the stranger and the alien. And he wants us all to learn together. And we can help each other learn. And he wants us to share what we learn with each other. And that's why we fellowship with one another. And that's why we can spend time in meals, in fellowship, sharing with one another. So he's gathered us here. Importantly, the feast points us to Christ. Points us to the source of living water, the source of the Holy Spirit. We need His Spirit flowing in us and through us so that it can flow out of us and others will see it. And just like His Spirit flows out of us, His light should be flowing through us and others should see that light. And it should reflect back to Him because it's Him's light. It's not our light. And it should all point back to Him. But they should see that light reflecting through us. It's a powerful light. It's like nothing that's ever been seen before. It'll shine not only in every courtyard that we enter, it should shine throughout the whole world. Christ is that light. Christ is that water. Those temple ceremonies pointed to that. We should be no longer walking in darkness. And through the way we walk and reflect Christ, others should not walk in darkness. They should see the light. There is a future that will come when others will be forced into it. God is working with everyone in His time and in His way. Just because He's got you here doesn't make us any better than anybody else. He's got a plan for everyone. And we need to remember that. And He's got a plan. And in the end, all will be keeping the feast. All will be celebrating together. In the end, He will dwell with man. And in the future, the Father will dwell too. And boy, will that light be joyous. So as we keep this feast, let's remember the lessons of the feast. Let's remember those things that He's given to us as we share with one another throughout these days. As we continue to learn the things that He has provided through all the different people that will be speaking and teaching to us this week. It's His word, not ours. And let's take that in and share it with one another. Let's talk. Let's communicate. Let's get to know one another. And let's discuss His word so we can grow. Grow in His light. And let's reflect it to everyone that we meet. So let's rejoice. Let's do as they said in Nehemiah, when after they had studied, then they went and rejoiced. They had food, fellowship, rejoiced with one another so that they can physically be happy and full, and then they can spiritually excel. So let's have a great feast. I enjoy looking forward to meeting with everyone, and let's get back together about one for the meal, and we'll close with some songs. Thank you.